Welcome to the Complimentary Podcast. I'm Katie Langerman with Anthony Hobday, and this is episode 32. Today, we're going to be discussing a book called Just Enough Design by Taku Sato, which hopefully I've pronounced correctly. And this is a book recommended by a mutual friend of ours, Gavin, on Twitter. I guess he just shared about it randomly, and he posted a nice photo of the book cover, which is always enticing to any designer. And we all jumped on it and picked up a copy, and we both read it, and we felt like we had a lot of things to discuss about it. So that's where we're coming at it from today.
Yeah, you say mutual friend. I don't know Gavin that well.
It counts.
Nowhere near as well as you know him, but the only reason I read this book was so that he would like me more. I think actually this is a perfect time for that meme, which is based on like Japanese anime culture, which is notice me sensei, because that applies to what I just joked about with Gavin, but also is a Japanese author of the book. So it blends the two worlds together perfectly.
Yep. Yeah. I will say I really love books like this because it's quite short. It didn't take me very long to get through it. And it's just like a nice, it's kind of a bite-sized piece of information, and it's easy to digest, and it's like kind of a relaxing design read, I would say. Some books give you some anxiety around maybe design related topics or also just like career, and you start, your wheels start turning, your gears start turning, and you're like thinking about work while you're reading this book. And this one did not do that for me. It was just like a chill kind of zen reading experience, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. Would you say it was just enough book?
It was just enough book. Exactly.
It makes me think of one of the best design books, which is Just Enough Research by Erica Hall.
Oh, I haven't read that one.
Yeah, I really love the format of the title. It really speaks to you. I don't know if the author of Just Enough Design chose that or if it was part of the translation process. Mm. But I've always loved Just Enough Research, partly because of the title, because it sells the concept. You know, all you need to read is that book about research, and basically you're a decent researcher if you follow its guidelines.
Yeah.
I think that's what a good book that covers a specific topic should be. It shouldn't necessarily be, well, the books that I prefer aren't necessarily introductions to a topic. They sort of take a position on it and cover the whole thing and say, this is what you should know. And then they become a good reference book as well, because you don't have to take it all in the first time. You could have this small book sitting on your desk just before you do an interview, for example, with someone, and flip through it and find the relevant parts.
Right.
So it becomes a lot more practical. So yeah, I really like any book that stays short. And actually, I've got a list of short design books I recommend. This does count in terms of the page limit, but I did not put it in because actually it's quite abstract and it's not really about interface design. It's about design as a concept, because he designs physical objects more than, I assume he's never designed interfaces.
Right. And we'll link that in the show notes for anyone who's looking for more short design books.
Well, thank you. But I did like some of the concepts in here, which is why I thought it was, which is why I agree with you, it was a good idea to discuss it. Because I think we can tie these back to the whole of design, including interface design, and not just, like, he's designing whiskey bottles and things.
Yes.
Not just that.
Yeah.
But anything, including interfaces.
I personally love reading things that are, like, parallel, I guess, to interface design, because it just like activates a different part of your brain and makes you rethink things you thought maybe you already had a strong opinion on, or I don't know, it gives you a new lens to kind of think about things through, which is I think probably why I found it a relaxing read, because it just was kind of low-key.
Yeah, sometimes that's one thing I like about reading about architecture and related disciplines like that, is because they're different enough that often they have different terms for things.
Mm.
But some of those concepts are essentially universal, and so they are giving you a different way to think about something you've already become familiar with, different words or a different structure. And there's a great example here. It's at the very end of my notes, but I'll talk about it now, which is he talks about the idea of structure and surface in architecture. And I'm always thinking about, when I'm designing a website, for example, the structure of the website versus the surface of the website, which is like, you could talk about the layout and maybe you even make that layout visible on the website by using lots of containers or sort of guidelines that make it visible. And then the surface is things like the more expressive, sort of less necessary elements you're putting in, including things like color. You know, the color's not part of the structure, it's part of the surface. And so I just like that he brought up that, even though it's not something that he worked on, it's architecture. I like that he brought up that that split, because it's an interesting way to think about interface design. You try and split things out, like how does that apply to the work I do? And I find that really useful.
Yeah, I also pulled, I think maybe I'll just read that quote because it made me pause. And as a systems designer too, I love like creating, putting things in little categories.
Oh yeah.
So he says, structure involves designing the pillar and planner. What's this term?
Planar.
Structures.
I think it's planar.
Okay, you're the expert here.
No, not at all.
And other
both of us got it wrong, probably.
And other functional mechanisms required to physically erect a building. Surface involves the texture and colors of its exterior, as well as doors, windows, walls, and other elements a building requires after its structure has been enclosed. It's a really nice quote. And it's fun to pull that back into interface design, as you said.
And I was thinking it feels more neat in the world of architecture. And then I started thinking about cases where it's not neat. And there are whole architectural movements where you make the structure the surface, like you expose the structure. There's also lots of things in sort of the more technical side of physical objects. Often you use the structure as the surface to go for this sort of simple industrial look. I think that's quite common in websites as well. You can make it feel very sort of organic and natural, and maybe that's pulling it away from what CSS and HTML are naturally doing. Or you can make it very structured and orderly, and probably you're leaning a lot more on this is how HTML and CSS sort of want to be by default. Like you're using less rounded corners or less absolute positioned elements, and using more sort of where does this naturally sit when I just put it into the structure of the HTML file or whatever. And so you can start to see how these things carry across. And it probably helps you get ideas about, okay, maybe for this website or this interface, I'll sort of make the structure more clear, and that'll help people to understand how things go together. Versus something more sort of organic and free-flowing.
Right. I feel like while we're on the topic of physical design too, I can't find the quote I'm thinking of, but I feel like he talks about like aging, like things should age over time, like how physical objects age over time impacts the design of them in some way, or like the perception, I guess, of them. And do you remember what I'm not sure, I might be making this up, but he said something along those lines.
Yeah, that sort of lines up with the idea of patina.
Yeah.
Which is like how things get worn down over time. And it's interesting to think about how that could apply to software, because at first glance, it doesn't feel like it does, because software doesn't really age.
Right.
In that way, you don't use it, like it doesn't age with use. But then I remember I had this, saw this interesting post on Twitter, and then it got me thinking myself, not Twitter, X, about ways you can add features to software so that as it gets used, it sort of changes the display. And one example was like, which parts of this document have been viewed the most? And we can highlight that on the scroll bar for the document. And so that's essentially saying, over time, the use of this, you know, file or software or whatever, it sort of marks itself in the software. And that's good if you want to go to a wiki page, for example, and decide and figure out what's the most popular part of this wiki page. Is there a way to highlight that? I guess it's the same with things like diffs, where you're showing like two code samples side by side and showing where the changes are. You're sort of highlighting what's been done to the thing.
Right.
And I guess that's how that idea of patina, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, comes through into software, is you're intentionally, let's show the part where it's been used the most because that's useful.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting angle on it. I think what I struggle with, I don't think there's a strong correlation between like some of the physical design he's talking about, where you're kind of, he discusses like creating something that has one purpose, but then it's reused for another purpose later, and it sort of just lives on forever. It's like against the idea that we're very consumerist and we just throw things away, like we sort of keep things and have multi-purpose. I don't feel like websites do that. We sort of just like burn things down and start over a lot. And they don't really, I guess there are some design principles that do stand the test of time, but more often than not, we see things sort of like evolve over time instead of, well, I guess you could argue that a lot of the principles we talk about are intended to just be that way forever, but maybe they'll change at some point, you know, if the medium changes.
Yeah, I guess it's because software is so not easy to change. I mean, obviously, we all struggle with changing software. That's some of the hardest things we do. But software is a lot easier to change than a physical object.
Right.
Or some physical objects. I guess you can change something with a hammer and a saw quite quickly, if it's made out of wood, for example. But a lot of the work we do is just to change the software that we work on constantly, because mm-hmm. we're trying to sort of keep up. But it does make me think about how some software is more multi-purpose and some software is less multi-purpose.
Right.
And so I wouldn't necessarily use my to-do app to write a book, but I might use a word processor app for all sorts of things, to make a list, to write a book, to keep notes on a meeting, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so there's definitely this sort of side of the spectrum of software where it's multi-purpose, but it was sort of designed that way. You know, it wasn't designed specifically for X and then it eventually gets used for Y. It was sort of designed for X and Y together. Although it is interesting to think about software that is designed for one purpose and then people slowly bend it to a different purpose.
Yeah.
And so the people who make it have to change it over time because they see this new demand.
Mm. I don't think you can predict how things are going to be used, really. And there's this quote from the book where he's talking about designing for the future. And he says, "What matters most is to thoughtfully envision the future desires and needs of the users. We should apply this to our daily lives as well as design." So it kind of feels like he's saying you should predict how people are going to use things and design with that in mind, which feels like kind of against user experience design, where maybe at least from my perspective, I feel like I can't predict anything. So you have to do research and like make a best judgment based off of the research that you have. But trying to predict is usually, you'll just have some kind of bias involved.
I do wonder if that's something about the translation from Japanese to English, because as I was reading that part, I thought it sounds like he's just promoting the idea of user-centered design or person-centered design to people who don't normally think about it. And I imagine like graphic designers and sort of the original product designer, but industrial designers, I imagine they maybe think about user-centered design a lot less than software designers do, maybe because they're trying to put their stamp on the thing more, like one person designs the whole thing and then it's done and it's shipped, and you want more of that identity of the designer potentially. And so it sounds like he was promoting an idea that for us is very standard practice to maybe an audience that for it is not standard practice for them. And so it felt like that point he was making was a lot more basic than you're giving it credit for.
Yeah.
just because we're so used to that simple idea and we look for something more complicated in what he's saying.
I think you're right. There's another quote that's related. I'm just reading a lot of quotes now. I hope that's okay. He says, "Having your own personal style is an effective way to gain recognition, but what are the consequences of a self-conscious style?" So I think that's sort of what you're getting at, of like he's taught his audience is people who are like the importance of their own personal taste. He does talk about taste a couple of times too, and like personal style, showing that in their work is more important than thinking of the end user. And so he's arguing that that's harmful to design and that you should focus on the user, which is, I guess, a kind of an obvious thing to interface designers interaction UX designers, because we're so used to that perspective. So it's another area where it's definitely leaning towards graphic design, but still interesting to think about.
Yeah, one of the points that he makes really stuck with me because it was about along the same lines. He pointed out that as you design things, you naturally sort of move towards your personal tastes, whatever you're comfortable with, whatever you're used to, whatever you prefer. I've noticed that happen to me so much. And if I'm allowed to design something on my own with no outside influences, it just becomes the thing I want it to be, which is usually very simple, very basic. You know, I try and keep it as sort of minimal as possible. Partly because that's less effort for me to build something if it's very simple. If I don't have someone else to come and build it, then why would I give myself the extra effort? So he talks about that, and I've noticed it a lot. And I think a lot of designers sort of lean into that and stick to what they know and what they prefer. And that can be helpful because obviously you can sell that if you're very familiar with it and therefore very good at it. And it's popular. You've got this like perfect, another triple threat, let's call it. that's probably worth some money, at least for a certain amount of time, until the trend goes away. But yeah, I've really noticed the importance of those outside influences that help pull you away from the things that you would do, maybe even unintentionally, if you were left to your own devices.
Mm-hmm.
Although I will say that probably some of those preferences are quite helpful and some of them aren't so helpful. So if your preference is everything should be high quality, maybe stick to that part of your preferences.
Yeah.
But if your preference is also never use any color, which is sort of close to where I get to, yeah, then maybe you need someone else to come in and say, it's a bit boring. And then you could be like, yeah, you're right. Okay, I'll correct that.
Yeah.
Make it less boring. I think when you brought this up, you talked about the idea of supple thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this like discussion about it. And I think at the time you were struggling to remember what the definition was. And I hadn't got to that part of the book yet because it's quite a vague, it's a subtle definition of supple thinking. Hopefully that comes through on the microphone. So I got to that part and I made sure to save it. And I'm still not sure what it means. Like he's quite vague about it and he dances around it a bit. Maybe he doesn't give a very good definition, but I did write some notes about it.
Let's talk about it.
And so, yeah, my understanding, first of all, he talks about supple thinking means that you don't blindly follow the pack or pander to trends. He used those phrases. So that's what supple thinking is not. And I do really like that because one thing that bothers me is that someone will experiment and try a new style or bring back a style from the 50s or something. And people will really like it and they'll really respond to it. And they'll start to use it in their own designs. And suddenly this style becomes popular. So this is especially for websites, but also you see applications going through sort of slower, shallower curves of like, oh, let's move towards this and then away from that. But then people become overexposed to that style and it becomes unpopular again. Great example is the web 2.0. Everything's reflective, convex, concave, convex buttons, you know, drop shadows, all that, inset text, all that stuff. Everything looked like it was shiny plastic. And so we get overexposed and we don't like that style anymore. And we have to leave it alone to hibernate mm-hmm. for 20 years or something. Which means that now that style is just out of the running. You can't use it unless you want people to think that your website is old fashioned, which is a real shame. And so I like that he's trying to encourage people to think more flexibly when they're designing, have a more supple thinking, and stay away from the idea of just doing what's popular, because I don't like that side of the design community.
Yeah.
Because it means we lose essentially what are good styles. It could be that you'd have a toolkit of 20 visual styles you could use, but maybe 10 of them are sort of out of fashion, and so you're not allowed to use them. And that's a bit annoying. Because if everyone used one of the 20 sort of every time in order, you know, then none of them would ever become too popular or too overused. And we could just have all the great styles all at the same time.
It's interesting. You have to like have this balance between, I think it does tie into like breaking out of your own personal like visual design and trying things that are out of your comfort zone, but also not just following trends. And being open to trying new things, but then not like oversaturating with these different ideas and new things, or maybe things that have been proven to not be great, or like things that people don't actually like. So it's like a, I don't know, it's a balance trying to, it's kind of overwhelming. That actually does give me anxiety to think about, because I was recently doing some visual design and I fell right into the same thing that you're kind of talking about of like comfort zone. What I like to do and thinking about breaking out of it was overwhelming because there's just so many areas, so many directions that you could go. How do you know which is the good, the best ones? I guess you get feedback from other people, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have rules sort of ingrained in my head that they're not rules. They're sort of sensible defaults.
Yes.
For example, the padding on a button and maybe the corner, the rounded corner shape or value. And I find myself doing those without really thinking. They're basically second nature or muscle memory. I do those as the default. And so to move away from that is already hard enough, because you've either got to intentionally choose not to do it beforehand every time for every one of those decisions. Like you've got to recognize that you're going to do that and then intentionally not do it, which at which point maybe you're just doing it for the sake of not doing it. And that's probably not a great thing to do either. Or you have to make all those decisions and then sort of correct them afterwards, which means you're pulling, this is a bit of hard concept to explain, But you've created this design, which is like style A, and then you want it to be style B instead, right? So you're pulling away from style A by maybe changing the corner radiuses, like maybe they're just squared off buttons or something, maybe changing the color scheme. But halfway through that process, it's neither style A nor style B, and it looks awful.
Yeah.
Because you've changed half the stuff and not all of the stuff. And yeah. So it just looks terrible. And you don't know what style B is yet. So you don't know when you've reached it. And so you've just stuck with this awful thing. And so you probably just start to move back towards style A because that's what you're familiar with. So it's got this like gravitational pull that is really hard to get out of if you're just noodling on your own and you don't have any of those outside influences we talked about.
Mm. I want to quickly read what he says about supple thinking because I think it's interesting. To use supple thinking is to become what you should become using your rational judgment without being swept up by trends. That aligns with kind of what we just said. Not doing whatever you want, but doing what you should do. That is confusing. In fact, yeah. Supple thinking transforms what you should do into what you want to do. It's kind of a twisty thing to think about.
Because he doesn't really define, for example, what you should do. He talks about objectivity. And it didn't sit right with me because I think part of the value of any designer you hire is their subjectivity. Partly their subjectivity. Yeah. Otherwise, if we were all perfectly objective, we'd all be the same designer, right? Because we'd have the same process, maybe in different cultures or something, but we can't all be objective and nor should we want to be. I think I can see that maybe he's also getting at that same concept of sort of user-centered design where you're saying it's not about designing it for me, it's about designing it for someone else.
Mm.
But then things like personal taste come into it. Like you hire specific designers because they have a great personal taste and you want their take on the style. And maybe you do want what they're selling already. Maybe you don't want them to completely start from scratch every time because they'd be unlearning a lot of very useful defaults they use. Maybe you want 90% of what they usually do plus 10% of what you want, you know.
Yeah.
Just put a skin on it that looks like us. That sounds a bit gross. Like a human skin, just like a skin suit. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. I think he's being quite vague just because it's not a particularly well-formed idea, unless he's just basically talking about try and take yourself out of the equation a bit more, which I completely agree with, you know. If you can step back and understand what you're designing for more, then you'll probably end up with a better design and it's less about just pleasing yourself.
Yes.
And if that's the case, I completely agree. And he does talk about that a bit later on where he says, I've got it written down here, how could you possibly design anything without initially becoming obsessed with it?
I loved that.
I really like that because, first of all, I agree completely. And I think it's partly because I'm a bit of an obsessive person. If I get interested in something, I sort of dive into it head first.
Same.
And I want to learn lots about things. And I think curiosity in that way is a really valuable trait to have as a designer. And I'm not the sort of person that will suggest that every designer should be that curious. You probably can have a successful career just copying the best designers you can find. But I think that obsession helps you to understand the problem well enough that the solution sort of becomes obvious in some cases. And you're like, okay, now it's much clearer what we need to do. And if you don't know what you need to do, maybe it's because you haven't spent enough time sort of obsessively understanding the thing.
Mm.
But then again, I don't want to encourage obsession too much because it can be unhealthy.
I feel like depending on where you work, like if we're talking about your day job kind of things, having time to be obsessed with something is almost a luxury because you probably don't even have the space to go that deep on everything you're working on. So it's interesting to think about. Like I don't know that it might be the case. It might be that you want to go really deep on something, but you simply don't have the time or it's not built into your roadmap or however you work. And so you can't. But I do think it's worthwhile to practice that in other areas too. It doesn't have to just be design, I think. Are you the kind of person that also goes deep on like topics outside of career focused things? Like, I don't know, hobbies?
Yeah.
Do you have a mechanical keyboard?
No, I briefly flirted with it. And luckily, I think I have some kind of built-in mechanism that recognizes when things can be unhealthy.
Yeah.
And can be too expensive. And so I bounced off it and got rid of my mechanical keyboard. And yet now I just use an Apple product, you know. Well, now I actually just use the keyboard built into the MacBook, which is you know, a great keyboard. Like, it's probably better than most keyboards.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is one hobby recently, which is, this is like quite nerdy and completely off topic, but I got into the idea of tabletop role-playing games that you can play on your own. And there's this like, there's this sub-genre which is purely designed for people to play on their own. And what I like about that as an area of interest is that you can design one yourself with just a word processor, and you can come up with all these interlocking rules about how the world works or how the mechanics work. You're basically designing a game, but it's very easy to design, unlike a video game, which takes a lot of technical skills. This is just writing and thinking about how things interact, which for a designer is like bread and butter, especially as a systems designer, right? You're just thinking about systems all day, so you're just transferring that skill to something else. And so I really like that it's very simple to make, but also very simple to use. Like, you just sit down with a pen and some paper, and you can suddenly start playing this game, and you can see how it feels. So you've got this built-in testing mechanism as well.
Right.
And because it's solo, you don't need to find other people to play with. So it's this very nice feedback loop, which isn't the case for things like, you know, websites necessarily. Mm. It's hard for me to design a website and then properly test it. Whereas I can design a game that's just for one person and then test it, because am I having fun? And if not, I should redesign it. So I have gotten to that, and I've been learning basically everything I can, and I find it fascinating. Mm-hmm. Which I find weird, because I've never played anything like that before. So it was sudden interest that came over me. And I probably won't play much of it, you know, for the rest of my life. It's just, it's a very easy topic for me to sort of dive deeply into and get some enjoyment out of.
Mm. Yep. I love that.
There was a point I was going to make. Oh, so one thing I wrote down, which is, you know, a slightly different topic, and maybe if I remember what I was going to say, I'll come back to it, is he makes this interesting point about how, especially in the software world, we talk about adding value. Like, we think that a software company is there to take, let's say, a process or, you know, maybe a technology like ChatGPT, and we want to add value to that because that's where we get the money, right? So we take something that costs us $20 a month, and we add enough value that people are willing to pay $30 a month. We've got $10 profit. Is a very simplified, you know, version. And he talks about how dangerous it is to think about in terms of adding value, because we shouldn't think about that as designers, or we shouldn't focus on that as designers, because it's kind of wasteful that we're always trying to add things to what's already there. And it's quite a subtle point, but I really like that he gives this example of picking up a stone off the street and using it to weigh down papers on your desk, right? So you don't buy a paperweight that's been designed and manufactured in a factory, which is the whole added value. Like, we took this iron and shaped it into a little miniature paperweight. Instead, you just find a stone and put it on your desk, and it is a perfect paperweight. And so he didn't describe it that way, but I really liked that it's basically recognizing value in something. And I think there's a lot of that in design, especially software design, where you could take some ideas and combine them because you've recognized the value in those things, and maybe just present it in a new way. You know, you if you design something so that you convince people it is useful, you don't have to change the thing itself much. You can just sort of recontextualize it. I think he talks about it from the sense of sustainability and saving resources. And so I quite like that. I'm not sure how well it applies to software, but I do like that design is not just about adding value, but recognizing it in the first place. And that ties in with that obsessive mindset of, do I understand this well enough to know the value of it?
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely something I see a lot. It's also, I think about like maintaining things that are working. I think this kind of ties into design quality, which we've talked about a lot, but it seems like the trend for certain products is, instead of like keeping a nice clean garden, like maintaining the garden that you've created and making sure it's a good experience and just continuing to improve it without adding anything, but just like maybe you make performance a little bit better. Maybe you've gotten some feedback and you need to take something away. We don't ever see that. We just see brand new thing that I'm shoving right on top of that other thing. And then it gets chaotic. And then the old thing, maybe it's a part of this new thing, or maybe it just dies out and it's just this like rotting piece of product that people really loved that is shifting into something that is not fun to use anymore for this other new thing. That's something I see a lot. I think he's kind of talking about not doing that.
And for how much scale affects quality, it's strange that it's not more common for people to take things away, right? If you know that quality can be improved by taking things away, it's weird because that's almost, it's not free. Obviously, you've got to rip a load of code out from different places. That takes effort. Mm-hmm. And it might be really annoying, especially if someone's just spent loads of time building that thing. But if you know you can improve quality almost in a guaranteed sense by taking something that's not useful away, especially because it clutters up the interface, for example, then I'm surprised we don't see more people do it. Although two examples that come to mind, because it has happened once or twice in history, but that's about it. Two examples are, I know that Twitter added a feature that was like stories, basically, yeah. And it went at the top of the screen and they got rid of it after 4 months or something. And so that was them realizing that a feature was useless and taking it out,
yep.
Which was a rare sight and much appreciated. And it also happened with Framer.
Hmm.
They had this huge marketing push behind building a website with AI. And you would type in a prompt and it would build a Framer website for you. And I suspect they spent quite a bit of time on it. And obviously it was part of the AI hype cycle, you know, like everyone's putting AI in their software. They were one of the early ones to put it in a way that was sort of seemed impressive on the surface. And then I think they realized it wasn't that useful and they got rid of it and they scrubbed any mention of it from their website. And I find that so strange because I was there for the announcement and everyone was getting really excited. And usually they would try and keep it around and sort of have it limp along just for the recognition. But hopefully they realized that it was distracting from their main mission, which is let's make it easier to build great websites.
Right.
And so they got rid of that and took it off the website. And I assume they took it out of the product, but I don't use Framer myself. And so that's, it's partly a critical point because they probably shouldn't have put it in the first place if they could have recognized learn. It wasn't actually going to be useful. Yeah. Ship to learn. But it's also a good thing that they did it, right? Because they realized it wasn't useful and they took it out rather than trying to make it work.
Yeah.
And hopefully they realized it was because it would have been too much work to make it work and not because this didn't have the impact we thought or this already had the impact we wanted. It made us more popular. So let's just take it out now that it's done its job. There's lots of cynical takes you can have on this. That sort of behavior. But I do like that they didn't sort of try and shove it in and keep it in.
Yeah.
The whole point of the book is just enough design. And one of the points he makes was, I'll read this. I think this is a quote. Most things can be perfectly well designed without details that call attention to themselves. I wrote that down or I saved it because it speaks so well to my preference.
Yeah.
And how he defines just enough design in the first place, right at the start, is perfecting the design of just enough. He contrasts that with not much design or not finishing the design.
Yeah.
And he said, maybe instead think of it as, you put just enough design in so that it's useful or whatever, and then you perfect what's already there. And that ties in with your sort of tending to the garden metaphor, where you take what's there and you perfect that rather than keep adding to it. And that's a more sort of positive, high-quality version of just enough design. And so, yeah, that speaks to the way I think about the ideal design a lot. So I quite like that as the, I guess, central message.
Yeah. I feel like it's maybe hard to describe, but there's a difference between just enough and bare minimum. Because I think he's not saying just do the bare minimum and make money and keep going.
Yeah.
He's saying like, do just enough. I don't know how to better say it than that. I just think, I mean, we've already talked about how much we like the title. So there's this like balance that happens where you basically perfect the art of just enough and it becomes like it's really great. It's not really, you wouldn't look at it and be like, yeah, that's the bare minimum. You would say like, this is really well thought out and well designed. And maybe there's nothing super specific that is drawing your attention or you're pointing out, which is kind of the point. It's like, I don't know, timeless, I guess is another term I think he would probably use for some of the products that he was talking about that he designed. But
yeah. I guess if you've got an element that attracts too much attention, then it's distracting attention away from something else.
Right.
And then why are those things there? Or why are you struggling to engage with those things if that really attractive thing is in your face?
Mm-hmm.
And it ties into that concept of the split between the concept behind the design and the execution of that concept. And so I think I see it as the concept should be just enough. But the execution, there's no ceiling on the execution. Like get the right concept, just enough concept. And then execute the hell out of it because that's where the sort of the value really lies.
Yes, I love that. That's a good way of framing it.
I love splitting things into two. Spectrums. Oh, and 2x2 grids. Uh-huh. I've had a bit of a love affair with 2x2 grids in my career because I just like how neat they are. You know, you can put things into quadrants and then you can name the quadrants. There's no better feeling than naming the quadrants in a 2x2. It feels like you're unlocking the secrets of the universe.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Okay, so a lot of judgment coming from the Kate side of the podcast.
That was deep. That was really deep. Okay, let's wrap this thing up then.
Yeah, I think that was just enough podcast.
That was just enough podcast.
There's so many ways you can use that as a joke.
Yeah, I feel like
it's... I think I was going to say at the start, that was just enough intro. I don't know if I said it or
not. I don't think you said that.
No, yeah, I had that in mind as well. Oh. There's so many just enough sort of jokes I can make.
We'll just carry it through to all future episodes.
Yeah, and that's just enough segue.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening to just enough of this episode. Hopefully the whole episode.
Yeah. 36 minutes, that was just enough.
Yeah. We'll catch you in the next one. Thanks, everybody. Yeah.